This is Polyphonic Press. The podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random.
All right, hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is The Clash, London Calling.
Oh, okay. I'm sort of familiar with this one.
This is one that I've had it on CD for a long time. But here is a description of the album. It says, London Calling is the third studio album by The Clash, released in December 1979 in the UK and January 1980 in the US. Widely regarded as one of the greatest rock albums ever made, it marked a bold artistic leap for the band, expanding far beyond the raw punk of their earlier work into a vibrant fusion of styles including reggae, ska, rockabilly, jazz, pop, and even early hints of hip-hop. Recorded at Wessex Studios in London and produced by Guy Stevens, London Calling captures the political urgency and restless creativity of the late 70s Britain. Its 19 tracks form a sprawling, energetic double album that tackles themes of social unrest, alienation, class struggle, and youth identity. The title track, with its apocalyptic imagery and rallying cry, sets the tone, while songs like Spanish Bombs, The Guns of Brixton, and Clampdown blend sharp political commentary with irresistible rhythm and melody. The album's cover, featuring Paul Simonon smashing his bass guitar on stage, became one of the most iconic images in rock history, a deliberate homage to Elvis Presley's debut album cover, symbolizing a new era of rebellion. London Calling was both a farewell to punk's narrow boundaries and a celebration of musical freedom. Critically acclaimed from the moment of its release, the album not only solidified The Clash's reputation as the only band that matters, but also bridged punk with the wider world of popular music. It remains a defining statement of passion, experimentation, and cultural revolution. All right, so this album was released on the 14th of December, 1979, and the genres are punk rock, new wave, post-punk, and ska punk. And it was released on CBS Records and produced by Guy Stevens. And it is a double album. So what we like to do is we discuss at the halfway point. So we'll treat disc one and disc two as two halves of the album. And so the first disc starts with London Calling and ends with The Guns of Brixton. So if you're listening along, which we do encourage you to do, if you want to pause at the after the song of The Guns of Brixton, and we'll do a discussion at the halfway mark. And we've both linked the album to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. All right, here we go. Here is the first song on the album, London Calling.
Your boys and girls, London calling. Now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling. See, we ain't got no swing except for the ring of the truncheon thing. The ice age is coming. The sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected. The wheat is going thin. Engine stuck on him. But I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning.
All right, and ending the first half of the album with The Guns of Brixton. I forgot how much I love this album. It's been a while since I've heard it, and it's almost more relevant to me now than when I first heard it as a teenager, but it's I'm resonating with the lyrics a lot more, I think. I mean, I've always loved this album, and yeah, it's just reminding me of how much I love it, even though I haven't heard it in quite a while.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. I can't think of anything negative to say about it, really. I mean, it's a lot of songs to put out, but it doesn't feel like it doesn't tire. It's not an exhausting listen or anything like that. It's which, you know, some double albums can be, but this really isn't.
Yeah, it's and I think it's because they're sort of, each song is kind of unique. It still sounds like them, and it's still, they all sort of fit on the album, but there's enough change that it doesn't feel stale. It's just, it's like each song is a brand new idea, and it's still, I don't know what's the word, it's sort of like, it flows really well. So from London Calling to Brand New Cadillac to Jimmy Jazz, like, it's just that the first three songs just, and it just keeps going where it's, the next song just makes sense that that's the next one.
Yeah.
And, but it's also, it's not, it doesn't get tired or it doesn't get boring. It's different than the last song, but it somehow relates to the song previous or something. It's really well sequenced, the album. They really chose the order of the songs really well.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it definitely, it doesn't come off like a concept album necessarily, but it's definitely an album with a bit of a theme. It's not, I mean, not every song has got, like, you know, is related to each other or something like that, but there's definitely this sort of rebellious theme to it.
Yeah, there's the rebellious theme, and then there's the, if you know what was going on in England in the late 70s, they were going through a huge recession at the time, and this music definitely reflects that. And, you know, when you think of, like, music from the 70s, especially American music, you think of, like the big acts at the time, or like Fleetwood Mac and, like, the Eagles. And Fleetwood Mac isn't, they're sort of American and British, but, you know, there's this, the big acts at the time, there was this, like, this warmth to it, and this, like, oh, everything is okay and everything is nice. And maybe the lyrics and what was going on with the band at the time wasn't, but it was sort of like, I don't want to use the word easy listening, but it was sort of not really representing what was happening with, like, working class people. And this sort of is, it's sort of like, well, okay, that's cool. And I feel like there's a coldness to this album, but it's not a coldness in, like, that it doesn't care, but it's just reflecting the coldness of what was happening in England at the time. And that was going on with, the big recession, and, lots of people were just out of work, and there was no jobs, and you know, it was just the music definitely reflects that sort of feeling that was happening at the time.
Yeah, you're commenting on sort of like the American bands at the time, where, I mean, this was what they consider now the height of, like, what they call now hot yacht rock. It wasn't called that then.
Yes, exactly.
That sort of, like, privileged sort of easygoing sort of-ness to it, which isn't necessarily bad. I mean, I actually like some of that stuff. But yeah, this is just a completely different, you know, side of the coin.
Yeah, especially in songs like Lost in the Supermarket and Working for the Clampdown. Like, it's like, these songs are, like, just, maybe they might not be explicit in what they're saying and what's going on in their lives and in their country at the time, but it's you get the sense of what's happening. And, you know, like a song like Lost in the Supermarket, it's the feeling is like, at least the way I interpret that is, like I'm looking around in the supermarket and making decisions like what can I afford? You know, what can I actually get that's going to feed me and sustain me until the next paycheck?
Special offer, guaranteed personality. I wasn't born so much as I fell out. Nobody seemed to notice me. We had a hedge back home in the suburb, over which I never could see. I heard the people who live on the ceiling scream and fight or scarily. Hearing that noise was my first ever feeling. That's how it's been all around me. I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer, a guaranteed personality.
Yeah, I can relate to that for sure.
And you know, musically, the band, they're not abandoning their punk rock roots, but they're just, I think they're just becoming better musicians.
Well, yeah, but I mean, compared to like the Sex Pistols, who are like the other big band of like the British punk rock scene, they always were better musicians. You know, Sex Pistols definitely have got there. I'm not here to shit on the Sex Pistols completely or anything like that, but they were definitely not the kind of musicians that they didn't have the musicianship that the Clash had, even from the beginning. But yes, they are getting better, and the punk scene and the ska scene, there was a lot of bleed over with a lot of these other bands, and you had like bands like the Specials and, oh, I'm trying to think of other ones from, well, even the Police. I wouldn't say they were necessarily part of the scene, but that was the sort of a thing that it's they're on the radio and you can't help but get that sort of, you know, that reggae sense coming from them and stuff like that. But it's this, I'm losing my train of thought, but it's that sort of like melding of all of these different like scenes going on at this time in this. All of them were very political at the same time as having this sort of like almost joyous, dancey undertone to it.
That is a thing. I mean, having, like making, I think we talked about it in when we did that, maybe it was like a year ago, the Frankie Goes to Hollywood album, where it was, the songs were political, but they were like dance. It was like dance pop, but it was like dancing was political. Like the actual like partying in hard times was the message. It's like, In almost in defiance of what's going on, and the sort of an act of rebellion, and it's like, no, fuck you, you're trying to oppress me, but you're not going to take my joy away. Like I'm going to enjoy myself because you don't want me to. And I think punk rock, even though it's more angry, it definitely has that, and it's no surprise that there was this sort of crossover of punk rock and reggae and ska punk, and because like there was a huge Jamaican population that had made its way over to London, and like you can't help but be influenced by what you're hearing, because if you're a poor white kid making punk rock and you're gonna talk to the poor black Jamaican kids and you're gonna share your culture with each other. It's just inevitable.
Yeah, if you're open-minded enough, absolutely. And these people were. Yeah, they recognized each other's humanity in through their each other's suffering in a lot of ways, and it sort of gelled them together, and many of them became, you know, bandmates or scene mates or whatever. And yeah, it just, the scene flourished.
Yeah, there was another band around that scene called The Beat, and they had a sort of a, there was like, it was a mix of Jamaican musicians via London and, you know, kids that had grown up in London. It goes a lot deeper than I think people realize. I think, you know, you hear the Police on the radio and say, like, yeah, it's got a reggae influence. It's like, well, there's kind of a reason it has a reggae influence. It's because, you know, it was around. It was just around.
They didn't pick it up out of nowhere. I mean, as talented as all three of them were in the Police, for sure. I mean, that reggae sort of beat that sort of carried through a lot of their stuff was definitely, you know, influenced by being around stuff like, you know, the reggae scene and the dub scene and yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. And, you know, they touched on a little bit as well, the Guns of Brixton. Like I always thought the beginning of that song, it sounded like early hip hop to me, just the way the bass and the drums were, cause hip hop is very heavy on like bass and drums. And so just the way that sounded, I always thought, oh, that would be, I'm positive someone somewhere has sampled that and made a song over it.
Oh, probably. It's probably happened a few times.
And, you know, and like the band getting better as musicians, like you hear it's not just like, even when they're doing quote unquote punk rock, like Clampdown, they're not, it's not just power chords and three chords. It's they're playing like arpeggios and they're like, you know, doing like different things and doing things with dynamics and the song structure and doing, they're just, you know, getting better at their craft in general, even when they're doing their typical rock and roll thing, they're just better at it at this point than they were on their first album. And, you know, if you go back and listen to their first album, it's awesome. I love their first album, their debut, self-titled debut, but it is a lot more raw and a lot more simple in terms of songs, because the point was to just get their message across. But I did manage to find a few interesting facts about the album. The Clash were living in a rundown rehearsal space during the recording, before and during the making of London Calling. The band was in financial trouble despite their growing fame. They'd been mismanaged and were broke, so they moved into a rehearsal space called Vanilla Studios in a grim part of Pimlico, London. They lived, wrote, and rehearsed there in near squalor for weeks. That closeness and struggle gave the songs their raw, unified energy. Joe Strummer later said, "We were really living it, hungry, broke, but totally focused." Yeah, and that definitely kind of comes out in the music, for sure.
Yeah, it people say you suffer for your art, but it honestly, I think it takes a certain type of person to be able to do art under those kind of conditions, whether or not they're, you know, just focusing on it to distract themselves from, you know, the appalling conditions that they have to deal with, the poverty and the, you know, misery. Yeah, not everybody can do that. I'm not sure I could do that, to be perfectly honest. I need things to be kind of going all right before I can start.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It's not something, I mean, yeah, I get it. You know, it's something that's going to distract you, but yeah, I think I would probably, I'd need to be warm and fed to be able to do my, art, you know, and get enough sleep the night before or whatever. And of course, the cover is an homage to Elvis Presley, the famous photo that of Paul Simonon smashing his Fender Precision bass during a 1979 New York concert became one of rock's most recognizable images. A designer, Ray Lowery, mimicking the typography and layout of Elvis Presley's 1956 debut album, symbolically showing punk breaking free from rock's past while also acknowledging its roots.
And we covered that album, didn't we? The Elvis one.
Yeah, it is probably his most raw rock and roll album. So it's kind of fitting. Yeah, producer Guy Stevens created a controlled chaos in the studio. Producer Guy Stevens had a reputation for being volatile and unpredictable. To keep the band's energy up, he'd throw chairs, pour wine on the mixing board, and shout at the band mid-take. He believed chaos created great performances. Rather than traditional production techniques, he pushed emotional intensity, often recording in first or second takes. Despite or because of his madness, the sessions captured a spontaneous electric sound. So not only were the band living in squalor, they also had a madman as a producer.
Is this like, where did he go to the Phil Spector school of producing or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, how, like, they have, it's amazing that this album got made at all. They seem to have everything working against them.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if I was, you know, even if I was working in like under the conditions of poor living conditions and whatever, and you know, wondering about my next meal and stuff like that, having a guy like that would probably kill my creativity. I couldn't deal with that. Maybe that's,
no,
you know, a failing on my part, but I don't know. I couldn't deal with that.
Yeah, well, I couldn't either, and it's no surprise really that, you know, this was the only album he produced with them. I don't think I could put up with that.
Also, I don't think the studio would appreciate the wine on their mixing boards.
Yeah, probably not. But you know, given that it's, you know, rock and roll, they probably used to stuff like that.
Probably not that particular one. They baby their machines, their big consoles and stuff like that. And, you know, this is 1979, so they're starting to become fairly big. You can get a lot of tracks on them now.
That is true. That is true. And, yeah, it's one thing to knock over a coffee or something or drink or something and, you know, you clean it up. But, yeah, to actually deliberately pour the wine across the console, that would be not, yeah, that would kind of wreck some stuff.
I mean, I have a 6-track mixing console. It's just this trainer thing that's, you know, I got it at a swap meet. But the thing is, I think it's probably one of the few that could handle it just because it's simple enough and all you need to do is just clean it out. But a lot of these other consoles, like in recording studios, professional recording studios, like, you don't go to Abbey Road and, you know, dump Chardonnay on their Neve.
And you know, you just know that the producer is going to throw the band under the bus for that one. You just know, like, just given that brief description, I just know the kind of guy he is, and you just know that he's not going to take the blame for that.
Yeah, he'd probably be fired and I'd pick somebody else.
But yeah, Phil Spector, he's another crazy one.
Yeah, he'd pull a gun every once in a while.
Yeah, number three, it's a double album priced as a single album. Yeah, The Clash insisted the record be sold for the price of a single LP, refusing to let costs prevent fans from hearing it. Their label, CBS, reluctantly agreed, a rare move at the time, showing how strongly the band stood by their working class values. That's pretty cool that they made a double album, but made sure that it was priced as a single album, because, you know, that's a big risk for the record company to take on, you know?
Yeah, it's more risky if it's an unfamiliar band. This band was, I think, at their peak in popularity, so I think they could probably get away with it a little bit better, but I still think that I would appreciate, you know, I good call on the band for, you know, especially, you know, the band could hardly afford anything at the time either. You know, they really did have like a class consciousness with their audience. Yeah, and they're full of integrity. They always were. I mean, you read anything about Joe Strummer and he just oozed integrity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's he got it. He knew what it was all about, and he knew. Well, and that's the difference between The Clash and the Sex Pistols. And look, I know it's easy to compare them, but, you know, the Sex Pistols, they were really a fabricated band. I mean, Malcolm McLaren put them together, and they're fun. They are fun. Don't get me wrong. I do enjoy the Sex Pistols. They are fun, but a lot of their attitude was just, it was performative. It was just attitude. It really, they didn't really stand for anything. It was just sort of like, it's just for shock value. But The Clash, they felt more authentic and more, like you're saying, class conscious, and knew that, you know, if they were to charge, and you know, they would have been perfectly well within their right to charge a price for a double album, because it is a double album, and it would have made sense. And probably nobody would have said anything, because, well, yeah, of course it's a double album. But just the fact that they made a stand and say, no, you know, this is our album and we want as many people to hear it as possible, so let's charge a single album price. And it's just like, just that little gesture means so much and says so much about them.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the song Train in Vain was a last minute addition. The closing track, Train in Vain, and in brackets, Stand By Me, was recorded after the album sleeves had already been printed. It wasn't listed on the track list, leading some fans to believe that it was a hidden or bonus track. Ironically, it became one of The Clash's biggest U.S. hits.
Yeah, it's a pretty good song. But I guess it was one of the first instances of like a hidden bonus track on something like this. Because they didn't tend to do it on records. They did it a lot with CDs. But I guess if you got 19 songs on there, you can hide one of them.
Yeah. But it wasn't even meant to be hidden. It was just they decided to add it to the album after the first run of sleeves had already been printed. So I guess they invented the hidden track without really meaning to. So those are some interesting facts about the album. But I guess we'll get back into the second side, and it starts with the song Wrong'em Boyo. So here we go.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Okay, and ending the album with Train in Vain, and in brackets, Stand By Me. Yeah, I think this is one of my favorite albums. And like this might be one of my top 10 favorite albums. Definitely top 20 at least. And I'm just, it's been a while since I've heard it. And I first heard it when I was maybe 15 or 16. And I'm remembering how much I love this album. I don't think there's really a weak song on it, a weak spot, which is pretty amazing for a double album with 19 tracks. Because like I was saying, each song is sort of its own thing. And it has its place within the album. And I think if you were to remove one song, the album wouldn't make sense, but each song is different enough that it holds your attention.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah, it is a good album, and like I said before, it's a double album that keeps your attention throughout the whole thing. I mean, there are other double albums, some of them, you know, by prog bands that keep my attention. Maybe don't keep everybody's attention, but they keep my attention. But this one is a little bit more. It's inviting in a way.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. It's inviting. And you know, the last song on there, Train in Vain, you know, the album can be kind of, it could be seen as a bit of a downer, in just given like what was happening with the band and the country they were in at the time, and crazy producer, and the songs, some of the songs can be kind of like a little bleak in terms of what's subject matter. But I think having Train, I think it was a really good idea, even though it was a late addition. I think it was a really good idea to put Train in Vain as the last track, because it leaves the album with a little bit of optimism and a little bit of hope that makes it not a complete downer. And it just kind of ties everything up perfectly that, you know, yes, things are bad now, but there's something to look forward to. And even though it's kind of about a breakup, the music itself is very, hopeful and optimistic.
Yeah, it is. It's, easily digestible for punk rock, but it's not what I would call, you know, it's definitely not like watered down or anything like that. It's just honest rock and roll.
Exactly. Yeah, that's great. That's perfect. Yeah, it's more power pop, I guess, than punk rock. But you know, the two are pretty closely related, I would say, And yeah, definitely 60s inspired, which a lot of power pop is. So yeah, but it fits. It just fits, you know. Now, having said that, and I know there are 19 tracks on the album, but what would be your three highlights?
I thought Wrong Amboyo was pretty fun too. So I think I might go for that one. It is tough because there's a lot of them that I really liked. Clampdown was really good. But I think my favorite is still Brand New Cadillac. That song's just great.
Yeah, those are pretty solid picks. It is tough. I think I would have to go with Clampdown as well.
Yeah.
I really like The Card Cheat. That was really good. Oh, geez, this is tough.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
I think I'd have to go with Spanish Bombs.
Yeah, it's another good one I was thinking of.
But Lost in the Supermarket is, and Rudy Can't Fail. Yeah, but I think I would go with Spanish Bombs as my third choice.
Okay.
Yeah. For me, I would definitely listen to this again, but I think would you listen to this again?
Oh, I'd listen to this again for sure.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it's a great album. It's like I said, I forgot how much I love the album, and definitely gonna make the time shorter when I listen to this again. So yeah, I would definitely listen to this again. Yeah, so I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to drop us a line and just let us know if you agree or disagree with our assessment of the album, you can do that by going to the website. Go to polyphonicpress.com, and you can go to the contact page and drop us a line. And while you're there, you can get all the past episodes, and you can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and all the places where you're listening, because it really helps out the show and helps listeners find us. And check out the Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. Lots of cool stuff there, like you can get these episodes the day before they go live, and get a shout out during these episodes, and even pick an album for us to review. So lots of cool stuff over there. And yeah, I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.